Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
The 21st century is full of challenges in so many ways, not just the day-to-day experience of life, but obviously coping with the trauma that sometimes life can actually throw our way. And so it's no surprise that sometimes we get aspects such as addiction tapping into our impacts and our lives and so on, and indeed it can take hold of individuals. This is at the heart of a fantastic new text that's been written and produced by our author of the week today. The text is entitled Goodbye Too Soon. And the author, of course, is the wonderful Canadian writer, Randy Lee Baslow. How are you, Randy?
I am good. How are you?
Great. Let me just check. I've got the pronunciation right there. Is it Baslow or Baslav?
Bosla.
There we are. Get that sorted out to start off with. Now, there's lots of things we can talk about in terms of your own journey and wonderful multiple range of books that you've put together. But let's focus on Goodbye Too Soon and how this is very much something that's true to your own story and has an authentic connection with that. And of course, goes in terms of the tragedy, really, of losing your brother.
Yeah. So the book itself, it's about when I... The very first chapter is when I got the phone call telling me that he was dead. And then it takes us kind of a little bit backwards into who he was and then progresses with planning the funeral and the grieving process.
And allowing for that, did you feel that it was cathartic? Did it actually help you process your own challenges? Because, you know, every one of us as human beings will suffer loss. Loss of loved ones, it's a natural state of affairs, etc. Did actually producing a text which had such an impactful start, of course, also help you process how you were coming to terms with the whole thing?
It really did. And actually, I mentioned that in one of the final chapters where I talk about coping strategies for grief, is that writing the book itself was one of the most cathartic things that I was able to do.
It's obviously available in e-format. Do you feel culturally this is something which connects us together as human beings, that actually everybody can recognize what it is to actually lose somebody, whether that's to an illness, whether it's to an incident, whatever? We all have that commonality.
Yeah, for sure we do. And we all have to grieve it in our own unique ways, but there's definitely a lot of commonalities to the human experience of grief.
Now, drugs, clearly there are lots of views, lots of perceptions, lots of debates about what is class A, what is appropriate, what is inappropriate, and so on and so forth. Brandon himself basically was a teenager when drugs took over his life, not sadly a unique story. This is something that, again, is part and parcel of the whole sequence. And you talk about, obviously, the battle that's coming through with that and that addictive nature, that notion of how you become connected to something. I mean, it can be gambling for some people. It can be food disorders. There are so many we can go through, and I'm not going to list them from that sort of point of view. Did you kind of, because I know you've had your own challenges, which we'll go through as well, but did you feel as though, yeah, okay, just sort it out? Because in many ways, there is one side of things which says, well, just pick yourself up and do this. And that is probably the last thing you can actually do, because the person who's actually the addict, they're in no fit state. They wouldn't be in that addictive state if they could do just that.
There was definitely a time when my thought was, why can't you just stop doing it? That was before I knew about mental health, before I knew what an addiction was. And I was the younger sister, 4 years younger. So when my brother was going through all of that, at the beginning stages, I had no idea anything about, but like I said, mental health, addiction. So I just thought, why are you choosing to do this? Why are you waking up and going, you know, it's a great idea if I, you know, make mom really upset today? Okay.
You know, that is the other factor, insofar as it's often the most challenging aspect to take that first step in terms of admitting, actually, there is a bit of a problem here. I need to actually acknowledge that. You need to almost let go and allow things to take over. Did your brother ever reach that stage, or were there several attempts when he tried to and then kind of slipped back, and there was a whole range of experiences within the whole field?
Definitely. There was quite a few times. And I outline a few of the experiences in the book. One time specifically where I thought I could help him. Again, had no idea about really what addiction was at the time, but I was like, yeah, okay, come stay at my house for a little bit and you'll just won't do drugs. It'll be, you know, everything will be fixed. Didn't work. And there was another time that he moved out west, thinking if I move away from people I know, then I'm leaving my addiction behind, except addiction is part of who he was. So that didn't work. But before he died, he was actually applying for a drug and alcohol recovery program that somebody through my aunt introduced him, actually. And he knew this program. So he was in the process of getting the paperwork because they had to send him the paperwork package. And it arrived actually after he had died. My aunt got it in the mail and she's like, well, I don't need this anymore.
The horse has gone and the stable door could have been bolted a long time ago. You're born and raised in Ontario, Canada. You've always had a passion for helping others, so that comes to the core. But you've had your own challenges as well in terms of coping with life and so on. Can you share with us again some of the challenges that Randy Lee Bowslow has kind of gone through? So the point of view, it's no sure. Well, there was the perfect sister, and unfortunately she had a brother who was less so, so
I
therefore this
was the
worked.
perfect sister. No. I'm still the perfect sister. I have two younger sisters, so. So I started dealing with my own depression around the age of 14. Multiple times I had actually planned how I was going to end my life. So that was, you know, a good 20 years of my life was spent on and off kind of deep depression and then going, oh, life is okay, and then back into the depression. I also battled cancer now 5 years ago, which is pretty awesome. It's 5 years. When before my husband and I got married, he almost died. Found out he was type 1 diabetic. My child, he's now 16, but my kid was diagnosed with autism at age 8, which was great because we had an answer to what was going on. But the reason we got to that point was very stressful, very hard to deal with, a lot of violent meltdowns. So those are just, you know, a little few snippets of the ups and downs of my life.
It's often said that we're very good at human beings at putting on the mask. Actually, everything's okay. I'm fine. No worries. It's all cool. We're going along there, a bit like the swan, smooth on the surface, paddling like crazy
I
underneath.
love that analogy.
Still working through that. I'm fascinated about, again, your line that you always felt that you were slightly of an outlier, something of an outlier, somebody who would be seen maybe as somebody didn't quite get it. That rhythm, it just wasn't there with Randy. Where's it connected? And rather than actually acknowledging again where one sits on the broad spectrum, and I emphasize it is a broad spectrum of autism that you've actually got that there are issues that relate to that. And do you feel as a human species we're getting better at identifying those things? Is it a case of it helps, the truth sets us free, or is it a case of, well, at least if I acknowledge that, then I can relate to projects and aspects which mean that maybe I don't put myself in a situation whereby I'm not quite getting it, not quite getting the understanding, etc. And maybe we could change the framework, the framing of how we actually are dealing with life and so on.
Everything you just said. So, yeah, I always, like you said, I always kind of felt a little bit different. When I was little, my aunts would tell my mom, oh, it's just because you spoil her. And I'm like, I'm not spoiled, guys. Like, that's not the issue right now. And then so I finally was diagnosed myself 2 years ago. That sounds right. About 2 years ago. And it just made my life kind of make more sense. So those times when my mom was struggling and I was having a meltdown, I'm like, see, I'm not, you know, crazy. It's because there was so much going on that I could not process everything all at once. But people wanted answers from me, you know, in a moment. I'm like, I can't do all that. And then instead of having the words to say, I can't do all of that at once, it was a freak out, as my mom would call it, and I would kind of just go like my kid. So it really helped, and it also helped me to realize how much I can take on and what projects, like you were saying, what projects would be the best for my skill set, as opposed to just going, yeah, I could do that, yeah, I could do that. Because technically, yeah, I can, but when I take too much, then nothing gets done. And it puts, the depression back in.
And is that, again, something which is at the heart of that challenge, that actually one tries to actually cover the thing, one does one's best, and ultimately, if you're doing your best, that's all one can ever expect or ever ask for from that point of view. I fundamentally think that most human beings try to do that. I don't think anybody sets out to say, I'm just going to see how lazy I can be on this one. I mean, admittedly, some people will admit that they're going to work it out, but you're trying to accommodate that. And somehow it becomes a bit like squaring the circle. You're actually trying to accommodate all views, and in the end, wind up accommodating none or very few, including arguably one of the most important perceptions, which is your own perception. How do you actually view that? I mean, we often talk with counselors who have major issues, not in terms of their professional counseling, but in terms of, well, who's counseling them? I mean, we look at global situations, we see scenarios from invasion, from natural disasters, from challenges on an internal basis. And if you're faced with, in a sense, that I use the term doom scrolling, if you actually go through social media and feeds with respect to that, and it's negative this, negative this, negative. On some level, it's a bit like we stare into the abyss stares back into us. We kind of need to ensure that we manage that time, that we manage our particular connections, that even interviews such as this, which hopefully isn't too traumatic, can be problematic in terms of where we're going, how do we're developing that. And do you think we're getting round to that? Are we succeeding? Is it a Western thing? Is it a case of, well, if we'd actually all developed a kind of Buddhist philosophy of life, this would not be an issue because we'd learn to take pleasure in the gift of pure being. There are a number of aspects that come across within that.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think it is something more Western world, because we do put so much stock into what is everyone else around us doing and wanting to keep up with the Joneses kind of thing. And so when you are scrolling, there is a lot of doomsday stuff. I mean, right now on my Facebook, if I was to scroll, it's all about the wildfires and our air quality right now. And yeah, it's kind of crappy. Yesterday you could smell the smoke, and we're not, I wouldn't even say I'm close to it. I'm a good distance away. And so I could scroll and just be like, oh no, that's awful. I have to stay in the house. And I could have that doomsday mindset because that's all I'm seeing. But you do have to step back and be like, hey, it's good to have information about what is happening in the world. However, I don't need to sit in it. And that's when you go and find cute animal videos.
You mentioned, obviously, it was 2021 when effectively you had that diagnosis of moderate autism and Sacher. Now, for many of us, 2021 was the time where we were beginning to come out of the pandemic. There are numerous studies still going on. There will be copious studies for years to come, no doubt, in terms of were there benefits of the pandemic? Were there stressful aspects? Was it a lack of ability? Was there a positive side from your own perspective in terms of did it give you some time to sit and reflect upon the life process? Or is it a case of, no, I prefer all the noise of the environment to drown that out on a regular basis?
Actually, I always say the pandemic was awesome for my house. So most people, whenever I say that, are like, oh, really? Because it's not the typical answer. So a couple of examples why that was the best thing for my house is my youngest, the one that does have autism, got to do all his schoolwork at home. I didn't have to fight with him to go to school. I didn't have to go and pick him up after he was suspended every day. So it was a relief. He actually ended up, so he was in grade eight during most of the hardest part of the pandemic. And he actually got an award for when he graduated, saying that he did the best doing for online. Like they created this award for him because he did so well. I never in my life would have thought he would get something like that from school. So it was amazing. The other thing was that my grandson was born just before the pandemic hit, so I got to spend a lot of time with him because he lived here with us at the time. Like my stepdaughter lived here too, and so we got to spend a lot of time together, which was, always a benefit because they grow so
This is
fast.
very true.
But in regards to your actual question of did I get to sit with my diagnosis and that kind of thing, I think that I already knew what was going to come out of my sessions with the doctor. So I did sit with it a little bit, but I think that I had already sort of processed it ahead of time before I even made that appointment with her to get it officially diagnosed.
There are few authors that we've featured in this particular project, this particular ongoing weekly series, who can say that they are kickboxing experts. That can be applied to yourself, Randy, and I see you've actually had over a decade or approximately a decade of kickboxing. Not just that, you're also Canadian national champion in kickboxing in 2015. You competed at the World Kickboxing Tournament later that year. And of course, in 2016, you competed at the Pan Am Games, where, of course, you received silver in your division. In 2020, you're chosen as one of the coaches for the Ontario Winter Games. So it's a win-win situation here. So most people would say, well, if you're a kickboxer and you're that level up there, what's the problem? Why aren't you sort of really kind of at the top? I mean, I wish I could be you. You could be actually, raising that issue. A lot of parents are, and she's a mother as well, and she's an author, and she's so successful. How do I cope? What's the secret?
Don't know. Can I know? Can you tell me the secret? The secret is everyone is different. That I think is the secret that people try to hide because everyone is looking for that one answer and there isn't. Every single person is different and every single person is going to need to figure out what works best for them. And for a very long time, kickboxing was that thing that worked really well for me. I've had to take a break because my body has decided that we're not moving as well as we used to. But it because it gets you moving, obviously exercise helps release your serotonin, all of those feel-good stuff. But there's so much to think about when you're throwing a kick or a punch. Like you don't just throw it. Whenever somebody new starts and I'm like, hey, no, you need to adjust this, an inch here, open your stance a little bit this way, a little bit that way. The elbow needs to, right? And there's all these little things that people go, oh, I didn't realize. I thought I could just hit stuff. I'm like, well, you can, but you won't be doing it right. So it's takes your mind off of your problems at least during the time you're doing it. And whether it's kickboxing, running, horseback riding, lifting weights, whatever it is, it gets your mind off of what's going on in that moment, which can then give you a clearer mind after.
We've done several features already this month about how just taking a walk can actually be beneficial. And clearly, there's an awful lot of scholarship gone into mindfulness as a way forward. Do you feel as though that appreciation of the positive, the appreciation in your case of kickboxing and so on, can really be a big asset in terms of, yeah, let's take it, overcoming addiction and actually dealing with these issues because your focus is on something more life affirming, more positive, more assisting rather than life taking in a sense, so quite literally, sadly, in certain instances, but actually, it adds to the experience of, as we frequently said, spiritual beings on a human journey rather than human beings on a spiritual journey.
Yeah, I think that it kind of goes back to that doomsday scrolling that we already mentioned. If you are sitting in negativity, that's all you're going to see. If you start to piece together some positivity, maybe it's not all you'll see because it can be hard to get out of depression, but a glimmer of hope is just that, a glimmer of hope that gives you the direction. Follow that hope, follow that glimmer, and eventually, you'll find other people that share that glimmer and it will grow and then you will prosper.
Let's focus on some of your books and your texts, etc. Operation Deck the Halls, I suspect, has a festive feel, and why not? A Mother's Truth, again, echoing that. Embracing Me. Let's talk about that one to start off with. Embracing Me. Is that more a case of, yeah, you need to learn to like yourself, not necessarily love yourself, but at least like yourself before you can even begin to start saying, well, why does anybody not like me? Well, you've got to start off with that initial point, maybe. I mean, I'm just suggesting it's a useful starting point. Was that part of the line of Embracing Me?
Yeah, it's part of that. And it's also part of embracing all aspects of yourself. So that's, I think, the part that comes with the trying to like yourself is that sometimes you go, well, I like XYZ about myself, but I really don't like ABC about myself. Well, you can't pick and choose what parts of you that you're going to like and you're going to not like. All of these things are who you are. So you have to embrace, and that's why I picked the title, all of the parts that are yourself. Some you might like better than others, but if you hate any one part of yourself, you're not ever going to be totally happy because you're still always going to be nitpicking at that one thing. So you have to embrace everything that encompasses who you are.
Which again is, I suppose, the whole notion of the smorgasbord of life, as we referred to the whole experience, that sometimes you have to have the sweet and the sour, and that actually goes working through that. Let's talk very briefly about Operation Deck the Halls. Is that actually dealing with planning for Christmas and planning for time of year, which, let's be honest, for many people can be really traumatic and really pressurized in terms of the pressure that the media, has to be said, often actually puts on people to have the perfect Christmas, the perfect family gathering, the perfect, name your segment in there, or the perfect Hanukkah, or the perfect holiday season. Again, sometimes, yeah.
I have yet to have that perfect moment. So Operation Deck the Halls, it was my first kids' book. And it is about Christmas. So it's actually is kind of a true story. So it features a little girl. She can't fall asleep and she's worried Santa's not going to come to the house, but elf magic happens. And of course, elves save Christmas and Christmas does happen. And now I say it's kind of based on a true story, not because, well, maybe elves magically came to the house. I don't know who's listening. But because that actually happened 1 year for us, my kid would not fall asleep. And so Christmas ended up taking place in a different way.
Yeah, I can certainly identify and see the sort of notion within that. We often ask authors about their musical tastes. Some authors have a particular soundtrack that they'll download from Spotify and they'll say, this is what we work through. Some authors prefer to have no lyrics whatsoever. Some authors prefer to have heavy metal sounds going through the process, etc. Some people prefer film soundtracks. Do you have any particular musical preferences, or is it a case of whatever?
Yeah, it's pretty much whatever. It's what I'm feeling in that moment. Like my regular playlist is anything from show tunes to rap to rock to punk, country, gospel, like everything. I like everything. Like there's going to be songs I don't like, but every kind of genre, there is something in there that I like. So it really just depends on my mood.
And again, that reflects, of course, on the notion that even though you might be feeling at your lowest, there's always some little spark of positivity you can find, even if it's just a case of being able to breathe in and out on a fairly regular basis, which is quite important, I think, breathing. So a line I often say to students and so on. So if we could use the magic of time, and Einstein, who once said that the most persistent of illusions is that past, present, and future are separate entities. And we could actually get you now to speak to your 14-year-old self, the 14-year-old Randy Lee, who's just having one or two challenges with life, depressing thoughts, and so on and so forth. What advice would you give her?
Well, it's funny that you asked that because the very first chapter in Embracing Me is talking to 14-year-old Randy.
We've done some research, Randy, so it's all good.
Basically, I would tell 14-year-old me that it does get better, but it's going to take a really long time. And the parts of life that we're going through right now aren't going to be our forever or what we have to look forward to. We're going to have much more important things to look forward to. And unfortunately, the crap that we're going through right now, it's going to come back and be helpful for other people in the future.
You worked at a native friendship centre for 2.5 years whilst pursuing a university education in psychology. We speak quite extensively again on the programme with Native Americans, Canada and the USA, of course, from that point of view. Is that something which again is important as the Indigenous peoples of Canada and, of course, the subsequent occupiers of areas, etc.? I won't use the term colonials, because that's got a whole loaded meaning which we don't want to go down at this stage. But is that something which you feel we're getting to grips with? We're beginning to share that, because in many ways we take a lot of aspects when it comes to the shamanistic elements of the life philosophies that were being manifested, and things like depression, addiction, and so on seem not to be present in those alternative cultures, different cultures. I won't use the term primitive cultures. I think probably different cultures is a different thing. Is that something which you've ever looked to explore, or is it a case of, well, no, I've just been working at the Native Friendship Centre and that's sufficient?
No, I learned a lot while I was there, actually. When I was there, the Ontario Federation of Friendship Centers actually put into place having all staff, no matter what their background was, trained towards a college diploma. Since I was only there for 2 years, then my contract ended and it wasn't renewed after that. I didn't finish all the courses, but of the ones that I took, it was really interesting to see how everything kind of worked for those cultures that we were talking about. So we were mostly talking about the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe, because that's kind of who is in my area. And then obviously, if you go elsewhere, there's different ones. So we kind of stuck to what was in this area of the Six Nations. So it was really interesting learning all of that different information, especially since at the Friendship Center where I was working. So I was in the career development section, like job development, getting them ready to go and find employment. And not that everything that I learned was directly related to job searching, but it was helpful to know why people would come in and say certain things based on history, which we were not taught in school. We were not taught the extensiveness of residential schools. We were not taught, you know, that the smallpox blankets, those things were glossed over in
I wonder
school,
why.
right? So it was really nice too to be able to take that knowledge and give it to my kids because, again, school wasn't teaching them. Even now, the focus is much more so. My kids' English class this year, in grade 11, it was very focused on the missing and murdered Indigenous women. That is more out in the West. It again glossed over everything else. So it's really nice to be able to talk a little bit more about it because it is a different way of looking at life, and it's not a bad thing at all. They have some really good like traditions that they use that, you know, keep them in a healthy mindset.
We've not noted that you were born and raised in Ontario, Canada. Is that your location at present? Is it a case?
Yes.
Yeah. So, looking beyond that whole system, and given the international range of your writing and so on, any particular countries you think, yeah, I really want to pay a visit to, Greenland in the near future?
I would love to visit everywhere and anywhere. My husband, he really likes sticking to Caribbean beaches. So we've done Cuba twice now, and so I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna start learning Spanish. So I've been using the Duolingo app for 100 and something days. So got a little bit. Personally, I would travel all over and see all the different places on Earth that I possibly could, which was the nice thing about kickboxing, because when I did go to Worlds, it was actually in Ireland, so I got to go there and I didn't have to listen to my husband go, but it's not a beach.
And again, talking about the importance of writing, I see that also in 2021, big year, obviously, you launched a YouTube channel, Write or Die. Now, some people say life isn't that binary, is it? Surely. But actually, for an author, as we often say, that's an essential, as essential as breathing to actually write, to actually get the development through there. So, again, talk us through why our listener today might find some solace, some comfort, certainly some information by going to YouTube, typing in Write or Die, and finding out the words and thoughts of yourself.
Yeah, so the Write or Die show, it really came from, I knew I wanted to talk about mental health, but I didn't know in what capacity. And I was talking to a bunch of different people and they said, well, you're an author. Why don't you just interview other authors? I'm like, that's a really good idea. So that's where that came from. And then trying to think of the name of the show, I was bouncing ideas off my husband, bouncing ideas off my friend. It was actually my friend who she co-authored A Mother's Truth with me, and she came up with Write or Die show. And I go, that's perfect, because when I was a teenager, I literally wrote instead of dying. So it was the perfect title. And we're at, I think, 149 episodes now.
So it's a success, which is wonderful. Well, that's great. Let's just basically go back to your body of work so far. Is there an order in which you would actually recommend people? I mean, should people actually say, okay, we're going to start with Goodbye Too Soon? Or would you actually turn around and say, no, start off with X, Y, or Z? Or is it because it really doesn't matter? Feel, go with what you're drawn to first.
You know what? You are the first person to ever ask me that. So I've never really thought about it. I would say whatever draws your attention, because each book really is a standalone. Yes, it's all my life, but I've really tried to take whatever part is a depression and put it into this book. Whatever part is about autism, well, raising my kid with autism, put it into this book. My brother is all into that book. So I did try to do it that way so you didn't have to read multiple ones. But I mean, if you pick it up and you're like, hey, this girl sounds pretty interesting, go pick up the other ones.
Fiction versus faction, which is your preference? Do you prefer a world in which it's created as an author, as you immerse yourself in it? Or do you prefer, in a sense, the factual elements of it's got to be biographical, it's got to be accurate, it's got to be journalistically precise?
If I'm reading or if I'm writing, because those are
Let's
two
try,
different answers.
yeah, let's try reading first.
Reading, I really like the I like horror. I like just straight up fiction. Give me something that is completely out of this world that I maybe couldn't think up myself, because I already live in a world of craziness. So I want to read about something out there. It could still include craziness, but I don't want it to have a basis in reality.
And as a writer,
As a writer, I enjoy writing nonfiction most. I think that that's where my talent really lays, and that would be why I've lived the life that I have, so that I can share those experiences. Because if I don't, then why the heck did I get all that?
almost at the end of this particular aspect, but I need to obviously ask you the question in terms of, when we're looking at social media, we've talked about obviously doom scrolling and issues with respect to that. Are you an avid TikToker? Are you an Instagrammer? Are you a Facebook girl? Are you, or is it a case of none of the above or all of the above?
Kind of all of the above. I mostly scroll on Facebook because that's where my friends will post things. So that's kind of where I do most of my scrolling. But I'm on Instagram, so I have started scrolling that a little bit. I'm not huge on just pictures. As an author, I like to read stuff, which is why I kind of like Facebook. It's the reading stuff. But I love TikTok for animal videos.
Yes, those cute, cuddly kittens, or indeed hamsters riding wheels, and or your skateboards can be quite an act to follow. What advice would you give to somebody who's listening to this who might be thinking about making their first steps into writing a book, whether it's fiction or fact or autobiographical biography? Would you have any thoughts that they should actually do? Any sort of thoughts or advice other than, shall we say, well, write?
Well, basically, that would be what I would say, right? But also, write and don't care what anybody says. Like, obviously, once you get to an editing process and that kind of thing, you're going to need to take that into consideration. But if this is your first time doing it, just write whatever comes. And you may never publish it. It might be not good at all. But that's the starting point, is literally just going with whatever your gut tells you. Don't try to write something that you are tailoring to someone else, because then it's not going to be true. And usually those ones you can tell are forced. So write what is true to your gut.
Randy Lee, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with you, good stuff. We've got two final questions before we say goodbye too soon. Maybe au revoir too soon will be fine. So we'll look on that. The first one, it's a we kind of become a cliche, but it's our kind of customer satisfaction here at Siren Radio and Madrid Drive Live, or Madrid Drive Morning Edition. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today? Has it been okay for you?
It has been, and you've asked some questions that I haven't been asked before, and I've done a lot of interviews, so I like it.
Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you keep us appraised of matters Ontario and more from the Randy Lee Bowslow Kickboxing School of Writing and Life Knocks?
Of course.
So we've made a great thing of the fact that it's World Oceans Day. We can go back to the joys of adventure series like SeaQuest, DSV, The Man from Atlantis, and so on. We came from the oceans. We emerged from the oceans. Why shouldn't we celebrate World Oceans Day? Well, if you happen to be named Spencer and Nacho, you've got especially good reason to celebrate World Ocean Day, because you're going to be released from Higgs Beach in Key West to mark the day itself. Who's responsible for this? Well, the manager of the Turtle Hospital, that's Betty Zirkelbach. How are you, Betty?
I'm good. Happy World Oceans Day. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. So talk to us a little bit about Spencer and Nacho, because they've spent the last few months at the Turtle Hospital, I believe, being treated for fibropapillomatosis.
Yes, that's it. So Spencer and Nacho, they're juvenile green sea turtles. They're the herbivores of the sea turtle world. They were rescued in the Florida Keys. They were being treated for that fibropapillomatosis, which causes horrific tumors on the turtles. They've had multiple surgeries, including a trip to the veterinary ophthalmologist where they had eye tumors removed. They've had chemotherapy treatments for this cancer-like virus that grows on them. They've had broad-spectrum antibiotics, fluid treatments, and a healthy diet. And the great news is they are tumor-free, back in great health, and will be returning to the sea today.
Well, this is good news for both Spencer and Nacho, but obviously the ocean contains more than just turtles. And we've also got on the program today the founder of the Plant a Million Corals Foundation. That's the fabulous Dr. David Vaughan. How are you, David?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So, coral, again, lifeblood of the ocean in so many ways. We've heard lots of challenges in terms of, the coral's being lost. We're losing it from that point of view. What are you actually getting involved with as far as Plant a Million Corals is actually concerned?
Well, we've lost about half the world's corals in just my lifetime. And in some places like the Florida Keys, probably a higher percent. But those corals that are still alive are resistant or resilient to today's conditions, today's temperatures, today's diseases, today's water quality. And so we're just trying to make more of those as fast as we can. And so we're taking those that Mother Nature has already decided are genotypes or strains that can tolerate today's conditions. And Mother Nature would have probably, in the next 100 or 1,000 years, grown them back slowly. I don't want to wait 1,000 years. And even though I may look like I'm 1,000 years old, I want to try to put back at scale at least 1 million corals in just the next 2 years. And we have to do it at scale because the ocean is so big. We can't just put one or two back. And it's not just the 28 species of corals that I'm interested in. It's the hundreds of species of fish and wildlife and the thousands of species of invertebrates that call the reef their home and depend on it for their livelihood as well.
And 90% of the live corals that once dominated the world's reefs have been lost. And you obviously raised your issue in terms of Florida, as far as that's concerned. Now, sadly, our regular Floridian correspondent from Miami, Kathy Manso, couldn't join us on this call. But if I turn back to Betty, what David's been describing there, it's very much symbiosis, isn't it? I mean, the classic way in which different species exist for the benefit of each other, and we need each other to survive as a planet.
We do need each other, and it's not surprising that the areas where the corals are most in trouble in the Florida Keys are the same areas where we see the most tumored turtles coming out of the water. And it's not a disease that's just affecting Florida and the Florida Keys, but it really is a global problem. It's around the world in warmer climates. The fibropapillomatosis is found on green sea turtles in and around developed islands, which tells us really everything we need to know, that it is definitely human impact and the runoff from our land that is affecting these beautiful animals. And the sea turtles are the oldest animal known to man. So they were in our oceans when the dinosaurs roamed our planet. They really are the canary in the coal mine, that indicator species that we need to pay attention. What happens to sea turtles is going to affect all of life on Earth.
It's nice to see that for emphasis, both Spencer and Nacho are making some little slapping sounds at the back there to actually ensure we can see them in good work, actually sort of obviously committing to this particular piece. David, I know you've obviously recently published a book as well in terms of the whole notion of coral, etc. Would you like to just share with us how people who are listening to this in leafy green Lincolnshire, England, can actually say, okay, we can still support our colleagues over in the States because we're on the same planet?
Yeah, I finished a 600-page book during COVID about the first one to show how active coral restoration can take place, all the different components of it, and 11 case studies from around the world. And as soon as I finished it, I realized that I missed the general public to to know and be aware of what's happening to us on this planet, our oceans, and specifically the corals, how great a wild organism they are, a symbiotic relationship between three phyla, a plant, an animal, and a microbe, all living together in one home. And so I wrote The Secret Life of Coral so people can know what's really going on with under the ocean and how wonderful and crazy corals are and that we're losing them at a fast rate. But I also give them the hope of the new technology of how we can grow corals fast and at large scale numbers. And then finally, at the end, really what every individual can do to change this planet. And it's 18 different simple things that everybody at home can do, from changing how they eat, changing how they buy, changing the kind of car they drive and travel with. And if those simple things can really make a difference with our planet, climate change, and what we're doing to our natural resources of overexploiting most of them. And so we can do something about this. And there is the hope for everybody that we can make this change happen.
Betty, you mentioned that the green sea turtles are the canaries in the coal mine, obviously different species, different environment, but still early warners from that point of view. Are you seeing improvements? Is the proverbial glass half full or half empty? I mean, do you feel, as David's been saying, that there is still time, we can still get on with this, but we have to actually act now?
Definitely the glass is half full, always. I'm the eternal optimist, and we are at that sweet spot in time. And the thing that is incredible to me is the education today. We are much more informed than when I was a teenager. People are aware. We have the education. We have the knowledge. If we take action, I feel that we can save our oceans and the planet, and in turn, sea turtles. Every species of sea turtles in and around the United States is protected by federal and state laws. We've come a long way since before the Endangered Species Act, when people actually ate sea turtles and about wiped out the green sea turtle population. So yes, I have a lot of hope. I think we're a very smart species, and with that education, we can make some, it really needs to be a cultural shift in what we do every day to protect our oceans and our planet.
And for people who wish to actually find out more about your excellent work in terms of the Sea Turtle Hospital, or Turtle Hospital in Marathon, are you online? Do you have a site that people actually follow and possibly support you in?
We do. You can find our website at turtlehospital.org. That's O-R-G. You can find a lot of good information, and you can follow us on the social media platforms. We do live feeds a couple times a week. You can follow our patients and get all the good information. And the best thing, you can come to the Florida Keys, and we have educational programs 365 days a year. So you can come visit us. And currently we have over 50 sea turtles we're taking care of.
We shall definitely be flagging that up with our Floridian correspondents for Siren Radio. For the moment, though, Betty Zirkelbach, manager of the Turtle Hospital, en route actually with Spencer and Nacho to actually be released. Do you think they'll come back? I mean, will they send a postcard? Will they actually be in touch? Will they sort of say, okay, thanks guys, or will you never see them again?
We never get a Christmas card, and I really hope they live a long, healthy life and that we don't see them back at the Turtle Hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. And also Dr. David Vaughan, author, of course, of Plant a Million Corals. Huge thanks. Inevitably, we started off with this. We'll wrap up with it. Happy World Ocean Day, folks.
Happy World Ocean Day. Thank you.
Happy World Ocean Day.
Okay, it seems sadly as though it's an annual thing that we cover at Siren Radio, that annual thing being, of course, the challenges when faced with sickle cell disease, indeed sickle cell anemia, which is obviously connected with that. And there is still, regrettably, a fairly alarming racial and socioeconomic bias in the treatment of sickle cell disease. We see a recent survey suggests that 26% of patients receive poor care from general practitioners or family doctors due to their ethnicity, race, or indeed socioeconomic status. And to actually address this, we're delighted to actually welcome a range of folk, actually. First of all, Stephanie George, who is a sickle cell patient. How are you, Stephanie?
I'm okay. Alex, thanks.
Which is good. Okay. We've also got carer of a sickle cell patient. That's Cherie Brooks. How are you, Cherie?
Hi.
Excellent. And we've also got Dr. Perla Eleftheriou, consultant hematologist at UCLH. How are you, Dr. Perla?
Good afternoon. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Stephanie, let's turn to you first. As a sickle cell patient, what is the, how is your lifestyle impacted by SCD?
So my lifestyle is impacted by the condition because it's just there every day. And, you know, obviously I don't know a life without it, but it does, you know, no 2 days are the same. Like right now I'm in pain and I've taken medication and I'm being able here to be here to talk to you. But you know, there's plenty of times I've had to, you know, I'll start the day fine and then I'll end up in A&E that night. You know, so many times I've had to cancel on friends at the very last minute, which I'm very grateful that I have a really good support system around me. My sister also suffers with the illness. So we kind of advocate for each other and we're each other's support system. But yeah, it isn't a debilitating illness that's very unpredictable and it does affect my everyday life.
So turning to Dr. Perla, I mean, you know, we've heard obviously some of the aspects there, and clearly we're looking at this research findings. I mean, I find it quite depressing, really. I mean, what were your own sort of takeaways from this particular analysis of people who are living with sickle cell disease in the UK?
Well, I think I share completely your impression, Alex. I find it equally depressing. So we had the all-party parliamentary group report in 2021, followed by the SHAPE survey results a year after. And essentially what we see from those two reports and surveys is that actually the same unmet needs and problems persist. However, the good news is that indeed, many decades after seeing this disease being neglected and under-resourced and understaffed and under-researched, now we are making progress. And there is certainly, from the NHS England point of view, the motivation to commit to tackle the care inequalities and the racial and socioeconomic problems affecting our patients, which directly affect care delivery. So there is improvement, and to be more precise, we have now formed specialist centres across England, which essentially, in collaboration with the local sickle cell centres, wherever the patients live, are collaborating to ensure that each and every patient has access to a specialist centre where the care provided is according to the best standards that can be delivered in the UK. We also have the National Hemoglobinopathy Panel, which consists of UK experts in sickle cell disease, so blood specialists, but also people from other medical fields, such as heart specialists, liver specialists, specialists in bone marrow transplantation, psychologists, but also patient representatives, to ensure that all challenging cases who might be more complex than the standard ones and who might need more specialist input are discussed on a regular basis. So there's definitely work in progress, and not to forget to mention the very important aspect of teaching and education, which has been enhanced significantly in the last at least 3-4 years with rolling programs to increase and the understanding and awareness of the management of sickle cell disease across the specialists involved, nursing and medical specialists.
I seem to recall from my A-level biology days that this genetic connection, a genetic constituent with respect to this. Just to clarify, sickle cell disease, is that related to sickle cell anemia? Is it, again, a challenge with respect to, again, the genetic aspects? And indeed, can genetics serve as a possible cure in terms of future generations?
Very good question. So sickle cell disease is the most common genetic blood disorder globally and in the UK, and it's actually one of the most severe genetic disorders, full stop. It affects the red blood cells, and essentially what it means is that there is a 25% chance with every pregnancy, if two people are carriers of the sickle cell gene, to have a baby born with sickle cell disease. Yes, in terms of cure genetic treatments are becoming available. They have advanced in terms of research and have reached final stages in clinical research. And we're really on the cusp of a very important time where we are keeping our fingers crossed and are very optimistic that there will be accessible to our patients in the UK as part of their standard of care. And of course, not everybody will be eligible for these treatments because they are high-risk treatments associated with the use of, with all the risks that chemotherapy and cytotoxic agents involve, but selected patients will have the option of this genetic or gene therapy curative treatments.
Cherie, you've been listening to this, clearly. You're a carer of a sickle cell patient. I mean, I was shocked to see that 91% of carers in the survey feel guilty that their child has sickle cell disease. I mean, obviously, we've heard from Dr. Perler there about the genetic aspect. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, do you feel as though progress is being made, or is that, you know, that headline figure that 26%, over a quarter of patients receive poor care from their GPs or their family doctors due to their socioeconomic status, their race, their ethnicity? Is that something which you still feel is just outrageous?
I think there's so many aspects to pick up there. In terms of the guilt aspect, I feel guilty every day having a child with sickle cell. I wasn't even aware that I carried the gene until I was pregnant with him. In terms of the care, I have a son who's 16. I would say there has definitely been improvement in the care, but there is still so much more to do. As a carer for someone with sickle cell, actually the whole family are affected by it. Stephanie touched on the fact that we can't plan, you know, at the drop of a hat, things change. I can send my son off to school and he'll be absolutely well. And, you know, I'll get a phone call 10 minutes later to say he's ill. We've had to call an ambulance. You know, so much changes day to day and it affects everyone. In terms of genetics, again, you know, I'm not a specialist. There is a lot to do, but we are very, very hopeful about the treatment that is on the horizon.
And I noticed, Dr. Perler, there are a number of fairly well-known folk who actually do have sickle cell disease. Some, I think, surprising. Neve Cusack being one, the actress, Adi Patan, Paralympian, of course, Richard Blackwood, actor and comedian, and indeed former footballer Ashley Kane. I mean, that possibly might help to a certain extent, but at the same time, do you feel as though, again, that question about progress, we won't be having this conversation a year from now where we're saying, well, I'm sorry, but you're living in that postcode area, so, you know, sorry, you're not going to actually do well when it comes to sickle cell disease?
Sorry, if I understood your question correct, Alex, you're talking about whether we are making progress in terms of ensuring equal access. Yes, I mean, that is absolutely the huge unmet need for in terms of management of sickle cell patients. So to ensure that there aren't health inequalities, that there is equal access to care wherever the patients live, regardless of their postcode. And this is the reason why NHS England has recognised this unmet for years, for decades now, need, and has commissioned the establishment of the specialist centres, which work closely, or should be working closely, with the local sickle cell centres where the patients might be presenting with when they develop an acute complication, to ensure exactly that the care they receive at the local non-specialist sickle cell centre is exactly what they should be receiving at a specialist sickle cell centre. And if this doesn't work, or if this is not feasible, then the patient should be transferred to their specialist centre, wherever that is. But also, we have to remember that sickle cell disease is not just about dealing with the acute problems, and the hallmark of this disease is excruciating painful episodes, but it doesn't stop there. It's about preventing complications. It's a disease which can affect every single organ in somebody's body who has a disease, and it's about preventing organ damage and providing the patients with the right type of monitoring in the outpatient clinics and offering them the treatment that they might need. And this is very much individualized care to ensure that the risk of developing organ damage is reduced. And again, this is the role of having assigned to every sickle cell patient in the UK a specialist centre, which is what we have had commissioned by NHS England in 2020, but there is a lot of work in progress to improve this project.
Challenging times indeed, almost coming to the end, basically. The pandemic we went through did also have a negative effect on people's awareness of sickle cell disease, because clearly we had a whole range of issues there, which the NHS is still arguably recovering from.
I think that there are a number of issues. Obviously, yes, we had the pandemic, and in the pandemic, somebody with sickle cell still has to go through their blood transfusions. Obviously, excuse me, sorry. They're also at high risk of infection, so there is the awareness there. So there are a lot of things going on. The messages that I would say is what is really important is that people with sickle cell rely on blood transfusions. So again, we are asking everyone to consider donating blood, and also, you know, especially from the Black and ethnic community, we need better matches, so we need people to be able to come forward and do that, but also that there is help out there. There are people, there are organizations such as the Sickle Cell Society that can really offer advice, help and information. So it's not just about World Sickle Day, it's about being aware of sickle cell 365 days a year.
Yeah. Sherry, many thanks for that. I think you've answered my final question in terms of where can people go to, what can they do to actually support the whole thing, and you clearly raised a number of organisations that can at least provide some help in the continuing line. We'll wrap up as we began, actually, by just turning to Stephanie. Stephanie, you've heard a lot there. You've probably had an awful lot of other interviews going through the course of this day and so on. Do you feel optimistic in yourself that actually, just keep on going one day at a time and things will work out?
Yes, Alex, I do feel optimistic. Obviously, you know, we have highlighted that a lot of work still needs to be done, but it's essential that we have these conversations and keep having these conversations, because that is the only way that change will happen. But we also need people to be receptive to these conversations and want to, you know, facilitate change, because it is going to be a whole collective. We need everybody to be involved for change to happen, but to also remember that patients are, so obviously we live through this with experience, we are expert patients, so patients also have to be at the core of whatever change is going to happen.
Stephanie George, Sherry Brooks and Dr. Paula Eleftherio. Hopefully I got the pronunciation right there, Dr. Paula.
Perfect. Well done.
Splendid. Many thanks. Keep up the excellent work and keep on going.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.